The world is like a ride at an amusement park. And when you choose to go on it, you think it's real because that's how powerful our minds are.
I can tell you from experience, the effect you have on others is the most valuable currency there is.
Don't think. Feel. It is like a finger pointing away to the moon. Don't concentrate on the finger or you will miss all that heavenly glory.
You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
So, who do you admire most these days?
Man, that's a very good question. First thing that comes to mind, remember when I was a kid, I don't know if you had a school teacher like who prepared you for a true or false or multiple choice exam by saying to you, like, if you really don't want to know what the answer is, the first thing that comes to mind is usually has a high probability of being the correct one.
Right.
And the first thing that came to mind when you said that was Barack Obama.
Wow.
Yeah, man, that dude's cool. He's cool, man. I think he, I mean, look, at the end of the day, I don't know if he's some puppet being controlled by the shadow government or if his policies have ultimately been the correct ones for the United States or blah, fucking blah, but he just seems like a really cool dude. He seems sincere, and the way he's exiting, there's something I remember hearing a long time ago, which is a man is not remembered by how he starts things, but by how he finishes them. I think we might have mentioned before. And he just seems to be finishing on a pretty strong note. It's increased my admiration for him. And yourself?
Interesting. So what do you admire about him? Other than being a cool guy and, you know, like...
Man, he just... You know, you can just... after a while, once you train yourself, you can start to get a sense of a person. Do you know what I mean? Like you can sense their inherent energy or vibe. And it's just something about his vibe that I've always thought was just very kind and honest and dignified. And it just seems like a very good, wholesome human being. And he's managed to, from what I can see, remain reasonably untainted from the lose-lose scenario that is being a politician in America.
You know, I totally agree with that. And I think for a long time, that's why many of us in the United States saw him as a sort of almost this elevated savior-like figure, you know, that we revered. It's like, wow, here's this handsome, smooth-talking, very eloquent, well-educated dude who... always seems very measured and just seems like a nice guy. And that biological mechanism that we all have that allows us to make snap judgments on people. You could just see a photograph of Donald Trump and be like, sketch, even if you never heard anything, right? Same with Vladimir Putin. Ashley and I were talking about this morning. It's like Putin's got a vibe about him that he may not be the most nefarious man in the world, but you wouldn't know it by looking at the
sure
picture.
He sure as hell looks like it.
Right?
Yeah.
And I kind of wanted to expand on that. Speaking of Putin, I'm not going to say that he's one way or another because all the information I have on him is very much skewed with the bias of he's an adversary to the United States, right? And so anytime you hear about Vladimir Putin, it's like, he's, you know, demonstratively terrible in these ways, X, Y, Z. I don't know enough about the Ukraine conflict to speak to what was going on there, right? But needless to say, he's always portrayed as a pretty negative guy. So maybe he is. And the question is, why are evil people so... If he's an evil person, why is evil so intoxicating? It's sort of a different question, but I think that it's against our nature to like want to kill and oppress and subjugate. But it's like when somebody does, they become elevated in some way and they start to gain all this negative power. And it never ends well. It's like you never hear about a dictator who is reformed, right? Oh, he was a terrible dictator and he decided to turn things around. You know, like Ashley mentioned, can you imagine if halfway through Hitler was like, you know what, these Jews are all right. Let's just let them go and try and live with them and stop oppressing people and stop trying to conquer and dominate. But it's like once this negative thing gets started, it just, well, I guess the spiral would be like this. It just spirals out of control, but we all have this weird, like, sick fascination, and I wouldn't call it admiration, but you look at somebody and go, wow, that's an evil person doing evil things. And I'm sort of rambling at this point, but why do you suppose evil is so intoxicating?
Well, again, the first thing that came to my mind is, it could be argued that the average human life is so middle of the road and bland and boring that whenever someone becomes actualized through shifting to one of the poles of extreme good or extreme evil, or maybe think of a different axis, like extreme achievement or anything at the extremes, is I think fascinating to human beings, because as I said, the average person is always looking for this homeostasis or this very bland reset point to move back towards. So I think just by default, if a guy comes along and he does some pretty extreme stuff that happens to be evil, I mean, people are going to respect that on some kind of level. Does that make sense to you at all?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the first thing I thought of. I don't know much about Putin. And I've heard his policies are pretty totalitarian, and he has all the makings of a despot, but he's a judo black belt, so I kind of have to respect the dude in some way, you know?
Yeah, I'm in sort of in awe of that guy, because, you know, he sort of walked away and then he came back. He's like, you know what? No, I'm going to take the reins again. I'm going to control this again, because I'm probably better at it than you guys. It's like, Medvedev, you step aside. I can do this better.
Dude, so you obviously have listened to the Dan Carlin Hardcore History podcasts, right?
Yeah, I love it.
You know that from listening to those podcasts, that the Russian people are just a different breed, right? They're just a different breed of human beings. They're incredibly hard. They've seen some intense stuff. I remember I was on a flight that just stopped in Moscow recently, and it was my fiance and I, and basically just Russians and a few Japanese people. It was coming from Tokyo, and I just looked around at these people, man, and you could just see they were different. They were all physically really imposing. They all had those like faces that look like they're made out of granite, you know. When you look at someone's face, you can just see that person's seen some shit, you know. They have not been like, I mean, the biggest decision in their life is not how to color coordinate their wardrobe. It's how to like not get killed or survive the winter, you know. And
I've always thought they were, as a people, just tougher than everybody else. Right. You just get that impression, right? Yeah.
And to think about this, right? To be the guy who rises to the top, who becomes the biggest fish in that pond and stays at the top, it says something about that human being. Like, whether, I mean, if we just cast aside the moral judgment or the value judgment on his actions and his policies, it's pretty impressive. He's a very, very powerful dude to be holding that position and holding it in the way he does. I know I couldn't do that. No way. And I don't really know anyone else who could.
That's a great point. Now, how do you explain somebody like Fedor, who doesn't look like the imposing dude, but was for a time the most dominant warrior on the planet? And he looks like, you know, a math teacher.
Yeah, it's wild, eh? It's wild. I guess there's outliers everywhere, dude. And in fact, sometimes it's the complete opposite. Sometimes someone who has a total baby face or looks incredibly kind can be a total sociopath, hey? And right. Also, often you see people that look like they just killed a baby and they're on their way to the Red Cross Children's Hospital. It's like, I guess there is some kind of correlation between your face and your path through life, but it's not perfect.
Is there anyone that you admire in the world of ethnobotany, like anybody that's doing studies with plant medicines that you think is like really ahead of the game?
Wow, man, that's a good question. I wish I had a decent answer for that. I mean, I always admired the work that Rick Doblin from the MAPS Institute, or the MAPS Foundation, if I'm not mistaken. I admire what they're doing, which is looking at how psychedelics can be used in treatment for various mental and physical disorders. I think that's really, really cool. But I also admire all the dudes out there who are just going and drinking ayahuasca or taking magic mushrooms and just like rolling the dice, right? That's doing work in the field of ethnobotany. hopefully you're going to be doing some work there soon as well. It'll take you on a trip.
It's just about time, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to be good. I'm looking forward to the day, Thomas. So the question, the time for the digital communion, 180 degree turnaround. Who do you admire the most? You knew this was coming.
You know, right off the bat, it's in a few different realms, right? I'm sure the person that I admire the most as a human being at the moment, and it may be misplaced, I'm just so in awe of this person, is Elon Musk. I just don't understand how he can do what he's done. Right? I mean, there just aren't enough hours in a day. And I definitely don't have enough space just right behind my eyes in this skull to house the kind of mental giant type steps he's taken. I mean, the $1 billion companies is one thing, but he has like 1,000 kids too, right? Doesn't he have like four sons? Yeah. And his companies are, you know, Tesla and SpaceX are in LA, but I thought he had another company in like Sun Solar Solar City is that, yeah, in San Francisco. Like, so he's back and forth between his companies that are actually changing the world and raising a family, and you know, then there's things like Hyperloop One and all the things that he sees beyond what he's already doing.
Do you not think that some of it could be attributed to the fact that it's kind of like when someone gains momentum or distances themselves from the pack, it tends to have a kind of snowball-like effect. So if you, due to whether it be a combination of hard work or timing or luck or perseverance or whatever factors or variables, you have some sort of success, it's much easier to compound that success from there on out. And so I would argue that, I mean, he's obviously an incredibly intelligent human being, but I'm sure there's probably like thousands and thousands of those of people with that kind of intellect walking the planet that we just don't know about, because his PayPal equivalent launched at slightly the wrong time, or he didn't find the right VC guy or whatever. And there's an untold story of a guy who's got like 100 Hyperloops sitting in his mind, but we don't know about that because he's still trying to make enough to pay the bills.
On one hand, I would agree with that. But on the other, I think what makes Elon so unique is that is that it's four or at least three such disparate industries. It's one thing to change the way that currency is traded, you know, and passed along and transferred with PayPal. Okay, well, if you stayed within that space, you'd be impressive in your own right. But then to go into electric vehicles, it's not even the same fucking ballpark. And then into solar, I mean, they're three completely different technologies. It seems like it. I'm sure there's some overlap there, but that's what's all the more impressive, is that it's oh, I see a big problem in this industry. This could be disrupted over here, and I can make a huge contribution to this. I think there are very few people that are able to diversify their skills in that particular way. I mean, Jeff Bezos comes to mind. Like, there's a guy that is visionary who's changing a bunch of stuff. And we mentioned before, he might be the world's first supervillain. Elon Musk too, you know, like those guys could go be tempted by the evil at any time and start building underground mansions and, you know, wearing suits. But
I just wonder I'm not trying to be argumentative, Thomas. This is where my mind goes with this. I just wonder that perhaps once you get to that level, your game has to raise. Like when you have, I don't doubt for a second, Thomas, I don't doubt for 1 second that if you struck it rich with whatever project you're working on and suddenly had a net worth of $10 billion and all you needed to do with the rest of your life was think about ways to work on cool projects and improve the human experience for the vast majority of the population, I don't doubt for a second that you wouldn't come up with something as cool as Hyperloop or SpaceX or any one of those. I don't doubt it for 1 second.
Wow, you give me way too much credit, dude, but I appreciate that. That's a brilliant compliment. I just think the anomaly, right, is to be able to break through with one thing. So the fact that he was able to, you know, both those guys were able to become billionaires with whatever they were working on has allowed them to then expand. Mm-hmm. But how far to become the 1 in 6 billion that creates $1 billion industry, you know, out of nothing in both of their cases. I mean, fascinating stuff. Now, I would say, so that's just in the realm of maybe technology. The more I learn about this stuff and go back, and this will probably be a subject for a different episode, is Tim Berners-Lee, the guy that invented, you know, the World Wide Web.
Mm-hmm.
I think that guy's got to be, if you don't admire him, you don't understand really, you know, his contribution, which is fine because most of us don't know where, I think our technology is magic anyway. You know, I was one of them. I still am. I still don't know how the lights come on when I flip the switch.
Is it just me or are you becoming a geek, man?
I've always been a geek. I've always been a geek. I'm just getting a little bit more practiced in what I'm geeking out about so that I understand at least ones and zeros a little bit better. You know, where they come from, how they affect the things that we do. But
I think that technology is a force that is just as worthy of worship as any other on this planet, including nature and whatever entities or deities we give our psychic energy to. And I'm so grateful for technology, man. It is life. I've said this before, but I spend a lot of time pondering on just how crappy life must have been back in the day when, like, I mean, you've heard that statistic or that factoid that the advent of the washing machine did more to change life in the first world than any other invention, because it freed up the woman from like 4 hours of clothes washing each day or something like that.
Wow. Yeah. I had not heard that, but that makes perfect sense.
It's wild. And just think of all the discoveries and inventions that are waiting for us that are going to have equal or even greater effects on our quality of life and standard of living. I find that very exciting.
At what cost?
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
There's always a cost, right? We've spoken about Wall-E, right? When they're just sitting in their little bubbles watching TV and getting served food. Hopefully it's not going to come at that cost.
Well, it in a way, and maybe this will be a subject for another episode, I think it is. Like, I'm not completely convinced, but I'm mostly convinced that man, I don't even know if I should say this. It sounds so wacky.
It
seems like Monsanto and the pharmaceutical companies that make drugs are in complete concert, and that they're poisoning people on purpose to keep them taking medication for their whole lives. There's a substance called glyphosate, which is in Roundup, and it's sprayed in every park to keep the weeds down, and it's sprayed on all the crops, and there's a decent amount of parts per billion in every genetically modified variety, and it affects the gut biome and destroys all the good bacteria, which leads to all kinds of negative effects and diseases. And then you start taking drugs to sort of mitigate those or keep them at bay or keep you alive or whatever it is. I just think that we're sort of like the Matrix in that we're plugged in, but instead of them sucking out energy, they're just taking dollars, you know? And it's just a way to generate income with mm-hmm. vessels, like meat suits walking around, giving away money to take drugs and eat poison. It's crazy.
Yeah, I had a meltdown the other day. My girlfriend and I, or my fiance and I, were watching John Oliver. Do you know who that is?
Yeah, comedian.
The comedian guy is kind of like a John Stewart, the British mm-hmm. John Stewart equivalent. And sure. He was doing an expose on how they won a legal battle that gave them the ability to restrict cigarette companies' advertising in a specific way. And a couple of smaller countries around the world were starting to follow Australia's lead. And then all the big tobacco companies basically sent them letters saying, look, we took the Australian government to court, and even though we lost, it cost this much, and we'll do the same to you. And I just started thinking, like, the question I asked my fiance, because she was a lawyer, I said to her, the lawyers that you know, the people that you worked with, like, let's say hypothetically speaking, you were a lawyer working for British American Tobacco, and you were given the mandate, okay, cool, Togo, this tiny little country with 800,000 people, wants to curtail the way we peddle or market our cancer-causing poisons to them. You have to put together a case that's going to absolutely crush them and allow us to continue to do this. Like, in what... to me, and I know it's the same for you, I cannot process the idea of doing that for money. It just doesn't, like... And I guess the question I was asking Annie is, what is the rationalization that happens in a person's brain when they, especially someone as educated and intelligent as the average lawyer from the kind of school that is required to work on a case like that? What is the rationalization? How, like, okay, they pay me $200,000 or $500,000 this year to win this case, and I know that the indirect and sometimes direct outcome of this is that some kid is going to be sitting watching his mother or father cough to death from lung cancer in a hospital somewhere because I took this job. Or do you know what I mean? Like, to me, it's just
two things, right? It's number one is the capacity for greed, for human greed, I think is boundless. And number two, the proximity of the issue. You know, as long as it's not directly affecting you, the whole out of sight, out of mind. I feel like we are such simple creatures that as long as we can't see it daily, it doesn't really affect us, which is why the media is so effective at making us go, oh my gosh, this is one way or it's another way. Because as long as you're bombarded with the images or the ideas, you know, it's in your mind grapes. So you're like, oh shit, well, I guess that must be true, or I should worry about this. But if you're a lawyer working on the case, and you don't have to see the people every day coughing up a lung with emphysema, you go, well, at least I got 500 grand. I can get a Tesla, and I can take care of my, you know, my dad, who's going to be in an old folks' home soon, and mm-hmm. et cetera. So yeah, greed and proximity, the two chinks in our armor for, you know, moderately intelligent people who know right from wrong, but just fucking push it away.
It's an imperfect world, but it's the only one we have, right?
Apparently so.
My man, that was very interesting. It's good to talk to you. It's been way too long.
Agreed.
Yeah. Until next time. You forgot. Don't tell me you forgot. Tell me you forgot.
We're all alone in this together, everyone. Happy 2017.